From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. A lot going on. Where do you want to start?
Thanks, Don. I have a piece that I would like to begin our discussion with. This was published actually May 6th, although to be honest with you, I didn't know until we were recording here. But this was published under the headline Syria, ISIS, and the U.S.-UK propaganda war. And to sort of put it in a nutshell, basically, the piece deals with something that came out in The Guardian within the last week or two, that while it's not necessarily a surprise, I think it is very instructive as to a lot of the things that we have seen surrounding the Syria and ISIS issue in terms of social media and in terms of propaganda generally. So basically, The Guardian revealed this organization called in the UK government called Research, Information, and Communications Unit, or RICU, R-I-C-U. And basically, this is a unit within the intelligence apparatus of the UK government that is involved in surveillance, in the dissemination of information, and in promotion of propaganda at the grassroots level as well as online. So you're talking about a government initiative that essentially puts propaganda out into the social media space about Syria, about ISIS, and actually was partnering with a, what can we call it, basically a public relations firm, a communications company called Breakthrough Media Network. And so what do? They produce websites, they produce leaflets, they produce videos, films, Facebook pages, Twitter feeds, radio, online radio content, podcasts, all kinds of things. If you ever saw floating around online something called The Truth About ISIS, that is by this organization. Help for Syria, that is also by the Breakthrough Media Network in cooperation with this RICU, this UK government operation. So in other words, this is basically a propaganda clearinghouse where the UK government is able to, without their fingerprints being on it, disseminate anti-Assad, anti-ISIS, quote-unquote, propaganda and basically proliferate that all over online and in social media. And also, and this is the other point, they had paid agents interfacing with college students to quote unquote educate them about what was going on. So let me just give a brief excerpt, very brief, from the article. This is not my article. This is from The Guardian. Quote, one RICU initiative, which advertises itself as a campaign providing advice on how to raise funds for Syrian refugees, has had face-to-face conversations with thousands of students at university freshman fairs without any students realizing that they were engaging with a government program. That campaign, called Help for Syria, has distributed leaflets to 760,000 homes without the recipients realizing that they were government communications.
Your all tax dollars at work. You're being propagandized by your own government. You know, I just want to interject here.
Yeah.
I keep, every time I see RICU, R-I-C-U, I think of Rackets Influence Corrupt Unit instead of the other, because it looks more like RICO to me from here.
Yeah, and it basically would be a RICO situation. I mean, this is a major conspiracy, essentially, that is being orchestrated by London for the purposes of, I mean, put it quite simply, for the purposes of spreading their propaganda, their line on the Syria issue. So think about it. I mean, just think about the implications for a second. This is something that, of course, we those of us who follow the Syria conflict and who follow a lot of these issues closely, this is there's nothing here that would really surprise us. But I think it's important and valuable to focus on what we can now confirm about this. So just think for a second. If you have thousands of students, just imagine you have an 18-year-old, this college freshman, okay, 18-year-old kid just getting into college, stepping foot for the first time into political issues, political activism, wants to get involved in something. And then here comes this, you know, veteran youth activist or whatever to tell them all about Syria, to give them these leaflets, to tell them what they need to know, the most important things. Now multiply that by thousands and thousands of examples, and you can see what's happening. This is the manufacturing of a grassroots movement for the purposes of pushing forward the government line, the government agenda when it comes to Syria, when it comes to the Middle East. Generally, and this kind of astroturfing of grassroots movements we've seen countless times before, and it's happening once again in Syria. And you know, just from the article itself as well, quote, one of Riku's primary tasks is to monitor online conversations among what it describes as vulnerable communities. After products are released, Riku staff monitor, quote, key forums for online conversations to, quote, track shifting narratives, according to documents obtained by The Guardian. So it's not only on the ground interfacing with activists, it's also putting stuff into the social media space to put it online, and not just to put it there, but to track it, to follow who's looking at it, to follow who they're talking to, and so forth. In other words,
it's
this
interactive
is...
interactive market research as it goes along. It hones the message and tailors it to the individual recipients as they acquire that. You know...
Well, that and also a dragnet surveillance program.
But of course, right. These are the people who have heard this, and so this is the set in which the opposition may germinate. Let's get them.
Well, there's that. And then on the flip side, this is also, you know, if they're putting out, this is not just about Syria and the Syria war.
Sure.
This is about the Islamic State, about radical Islam. So imagine what they're doing. They're essentially... you know, just like the FBI, which has been caught countless times basically staging terrorist actions, right? Providing the explosives, setting up these patsies and then busting them to say that they, you know, are successfully foiling terrorist plots.
Newberg 4, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see the same thing happening here. They're putting out, you know, imagine they put out, you know, pro-ISIS content, and they say it's so that they can track who's interested in it and they can counter the sort of radicalization. But in fact, it's really an entrapment program.
Of
so
course.
There's a number of layers to what they're doing. Essentially, this Riku unit is more or less sort of, I would say, the hub of, like, you know, the spokes on a wheel, right? They've got their sort of cyber fingers in all sorts of pies. None of it is good.
And as you see the hub in the spokes on a wheel, it of course suggests very strongly the existence of the vehicle to which it's affixed, which is a much larger Megillah. You have in your article, for example, a reference to the U.S. program, Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications.
That's what I was going to get to, yep.
And also, though, before we get to that, you know, the whole Megillah, you know, the total information domination matrix. You've got the U.S. media. You know, there are so many facts about Syria that don't ever get even recited in the U.S. media. Maybe a couple filtered through Trump in the midst of some Tourette's outburst. And some reference by Sanders, although not much, and not necessarily a condemnation either, but otherwise just that are never present in the media whatsoever. And in addition to the media, of course, you have the absence of international, of the U.S. media, you have the absence even in international media. If you follow, like I do daily, multiply each day, actually, the UN media outlets that, you know, the UN media materials that are provided by the UN apparatus, you know, you have things like the other day, the deputy permanent representative of Syria was sitting at this UN Security Council meeting laying out their country's position, and it took them a day and a half to put out an English translation of it while all of the materials that were put out by the U.S., New Zealand, the U.K., all of the people that are presenting that one narrative, that was all out immediately. So yeah. It's like, you know, total full spectrum.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And again, I mean, the other obvious point here is that this is in addition to the longstanding relations that we know are there between the official government organs and the so-called private media, right? Because the corporate media, whether in the US or in the UK or really anywhere, the media is in many ways deeply and intimately connected with the government. So let's just think back to the Iraq War. The lead up to the Iraq War is a good example. I mean, the major organs of so-called privately owned media were basically parroting the talking points that were provided to them by the Pentagon, by the State Department, by the White House, and so forth. They act as essentially unofficial mouthpieces of the political establishment. So when you talk about full spectrum, it's not only full spectrum in terms of the outlets and channels that the government apparatus directly controls, it's also the ones that it doesn't control but that are beholden to it.
And you know, looking at that, let's take a look through that particular style of communications, to be gentle, at what's happening in Brazil right now.
Yeah, I mean, I thought you had more of a question there. Basically, you see something actually happening in Brazil that is, in my view, directly attributable to the media, right? I don't know, and it's impossible to say for certain, but I don't know how much, if at all, there would even be a movement to impeach Rousseff were it not for the privately controlled anti-government, pro-right-wing media in Brazil, which is mostly, if not entirely, controlled by the former ruling class, the elites, the right-wing elites, who are directly connected to Washington and to Wall Street as they are all over Latin America. We saw the same thing in Venezuela, for that matter. You know, as the government tried to create public media institutions, even in Venezuela, it remained mostly in the hands of the right wing that would use the media to undermine the government.
Yeah, by far. I mean, and you have
not even close.
And the attempts, you know, the obvious, attempts to dominate the entire narrative by that same construct, you saw evident in the coup in 2002 in Venezuela, when they bombed the only public television station available to provide a counter-narrative, by Macri, who's one of his first moves when he was elected in December in Argentina, was to try to repeal the media law that created some alternative space in the media there. And also they're pulling out of Telesur right away after he took office.
Yeah, and they fear these media institutions tremendously, because they understand that the case, their political case, is flimsy at best, and that they need these media outlets in order to sort of justify their narrative. And I think that, you know, if I could just briefly, before we go too far on the Brazil question, if I could just return to the article, because I want to address another point here. And that is that it's not just the direct government, you know, units like RICU in London, or like the CSCC in the U.S., we also know very clearly, and this is also documented, the extent to which the government and intelligence apparatus not only penetrate but actually are able to manipulate, social media. Okay, so I think it was The Intercept just a few weeks ago. I don't think it was Glenn Greenwald. One of their other reporters wrote a piece that I think really was a good piece, and it validated something I had written a few years ago. Others had written about it as well, namely that the CIA is directly investing millions and millions of dollars in actually quite literally dozens and dozens of different companies, tech startups, social media related, that are all in an attempt to do everything from data mining to controlling the narrative to real-time surveillance to all sorts of things using social media and new tools available in social media. This is done through the CIA's investment arm known as InQtel. And, you know, this is something that we've known about for a long time. Now, I want people to remember now, if you're new to some of these issues, then you won't remember this. But for those of us that were really active during the war on Libya, one of the things that was most striking, and for a lot of people, myself included, that was really when I was first getting engaged with Twitter. And a lot of us noticed at the time that there were certain key Twitter accounts that were constantly providing so-called intelligence and information and quote-unquote citizen journalism on the ground in Libya. Right. And some of these major Twitter accounts were actually feeding the information that was being used by CNN and others, including most infamously the strafing of Benghazi civilians, quote-unquote, which allegedly had been carried out by Gaddafi's forces, which was first reported via Twitter via one of these accounts. Now, I remember—
Let me just interrupt.
Yeah.
By the way, none of those accounts ever published the almost immediate response from the Russian military showing the aerial photography of that area during the alleged encounters.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And these accounts, which purportedly were just ordinary Libyan citizens who were, doing their duty, telling the truth, etc. These accounts, first of all, the amount of internet access, let alone access to Twitter in the English language in Libya was minuscule. You're talking probably a handful of people in the entire country.
Mataba is a notable exception at that point.
Yeah, I mean, there was a few, but be that as it may, these Twitter accounts, I remember them. Some of them had like 10, 20, 30, 40, 50,000 followers.
Right.
Okay. Now, anybody who's used Twitter in a genuine way, as I have, as many of us have, knows how hard it is to build a Twitter following of that size, of any size,
right?
I've been on Twitter for a number of years, not tweeting all the time, but tweeting relatively regularly, and I have a couple of thousand of people who follow me. If you're a major TV celebrity, sure, you can easily build up a following of tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people. But if you're just a citizen journalist, you don't have that kind of following. So where am I going with all of this? I remember at that time thinking to myself, these Twitter accounts are fake. They have to be fake. Mm-hmm. I don't believe these are genuine. And then I remember finding, this was a few months after it was published, finding this story published in a relatively source I wouldn't normally think to look at, PC World. The article headline, Army of Fake Social Media Friends to Promote Propaganda. Okay, and then I remember reading that and I was stunned because I knew I had known intuitively that this was happening. And here's the quote from that article, quote, U.S. government contracted H.B. Gary Federal for the development of software which could create multiple fake social media profiles to manipulate and sway public opinion on controversial issues by promoting propaganda. It could also be used as surveillance to find public opinions with points of view the powers that be didn't like. It could then potentially have their fake people run smear campaigns against real people. And I mean, it immediately clicked for me back then. We're not talking like 5 years years ago now, it clicked for me back then what they were doing with Twitter, yeah, what they were doing with Facebook, how social media served this war-making function. And so every time I come across a new story explaining or detailing this or that level of manipulation online, in social media, or even in real time, it all connects back to some of these other stories that, in my view, paint a much grander picture of how propaganda is being manufactured and disseminated in all of these platforms.
You know, let's take it a step further, because this is something that I knew intuitively, knowing this fundamental fact. The internet itself is clearly a means of conducting mediated, by the medium itself, mediated conversations with, you know, masses of people or individuals and everything in between. And by the way, it is essentially the DARPANET, the Defense Advanced Research Project internet. And so the mediator, the identity of the mediator, is pretty clear. The question only becomes exactly how broadly and deeply can they accumulate and process this information and regurgitate it back. And what you have found and what you're talking about here is a rather sophisticated subset of all of that. If you grow that large, you realize, damn, they might be involved in what I'm seeing, hearing, thinking, and saying a lot more deeply than I imagined.
That's right. That's exactly right. And actually, even taking it further than that, they're not only involved in mediating the communication, they're actually involved, in my view, in at the very beginning stages, at square one of the development of the medium themselves, okay? So right. Twitter and Facebook and Google and all of these giants in social media and in internet, they all in various ways have connections with InQtel, which is the investment arm of the CIA. So if you think about how these companies got developed, why did Twitter grow the way that it grew? Why did it explode onto the, you know, public scene? I remember, like, I had heard of this thing called Twitter. I didn't know too much about it. I wasn't really into social media at the time. Wasn't doing Facebook or anything like that. And I remember this thing called Twitter came around and I was like, well, that seems dumb. And then within a couple of months, it was like literally every reporter, every right. journalist, every right. news media outlet
major
had a Twitter
promotion.
Account, was using Twitter. I mean, it was like out of nowhere. And I realized even back then, like, whoa, there's something more to Twitter than just a social media presence.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, when you promote something like that, imagine how many hits you would get at stopimperialism.org if for a month or two, every CNN, MSNBC, Fox, and other reporters mentioned the website.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's precisely my point. And that's why, you know, just bringing it back to this Libya thing, we had like dozens of these kinds of accounts with tens of thousands of followers. Now think about that. If that means that a lot of those accounts, I don't know that we could say all, but if a lot of those accounts were in fact fake accounts created by either the software that that the government was using or by actual paid trolls, as we know Israel has a whole army of online trolls that they pay to do pro-Israeli propaganda online, whether or not it was a human being doing this or an actual software program, either way, what we know is it had a direct impact on the nature of the reporting about what was happening in Libya at the time. It had a major impact. It had a major impact in the conversation in the social media space, which then also got reported. So you see, there's like two layers of it. One, it's the source of the information. Two, the conversation becomes part of the story, which then serves to validate a narrative. So, I think it is important then to also provide an example of how this is also done, you know, and I just give one or a couple of examples here in the piece. The first example that we should be, you know, aware of is those people who follow Twitter closely and try to get information from Twitter may know of this account called @ShamiWitness. And Shammy Witness was for a long time considered the preeminent source on Twitter, on social media, for information about ISIS, that he was considered, quote unquote, an ISIS Twitter propagandist. The media outlets CNN and BBC and others would use Shammy Witness to basically provide inside information about how ISIS worked, who was being recruited, all sorts of information. Well, guess what? Turns out Shammy Witness is an Indian guy living in Bangalore working for a public relations firm, a guy named Mehdi Biswas, who is advertising executive in Bangalore. He's now been charged with, like, conspiracy, supporting a terrorist organization, etc., you know, a bunch of stuff. Now, for a long time, though, official media channels were citing this guy and then filtering that through other quote-unquote reliable bloggers like Brown Moses, a.k.a. Elliot Higgins, who, you know, supposedly does this citizen journalism, debunking official narratives. If you recall, Brown Moses was supposedly the one who proved that the Assad forces had launched a chemical attack on Ghouta in August of 2013. He had supposedly proven using satellite imagery that the Russians had shot down MH17. This is somebody who is now, who was originally a blogger, who now I think is partnered with The Atlantic, The Atlantic Foundation. I forget exactly where he's working now, but he's basically been absorbed into the establishment. So you have a fake Twitter user or, you know, claiming to be sort of this ISIS member, an ISIS propaganda outlet, that being filtered through what I would also consider to be a government agent, this guy Elliot Higgins, and that then comes out into the mainstream in its finalized form. You could see the sophistication of this kind of a propaganda matrix where you have multiple layers of manufactured information that then comes out as authentic and genuine.
Yeah, well, you know, sitting at my cubicle here, playing Winston Smith, manipulating the collective memory of the society, you have on Facebook this thing that shows what you posted 2 years ago or whatever, supposedly. Now, if you were to go through your own history, gee, what did I write 3 years ago on Facebook? It'll take you about a month to get there if you ever did without crashing your browser. But they regurgitate something that you allegedly wrote like 2 years ago, which, if nothing else, shows a capacity to change the historical record at will. You know, okay, so we have all that going on. In addition to that, you have the U.S. removing its restrictions on its own avowed propaganda arms, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, all that stuff. They are now free to propagandize us. In other words, news outlets here can carry those as valid news reports, and the things that we paid for to propagandize others are now being used to propagandize us, and a partnership with a Russian oligarch in exactly that project. So, I mean, it's so many layers and so many levels that it's a complete dominance of the narrative.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason, all of these things we're talking about is part of the reason why they have such a problem with non-Western media. And whether it's RT, whether it's Telesur, whether it's Press TV, whether it's even CCTV, or any of these non-Western outlets, this is why they consider them to be quote-unquote invalid, to be, not trustworthy.
National security threat.
Right, a national security threat. And the reason is because in one sense, they're not wrong. It is a major threat.
Right.
If you consider the media to be part of the national apparatus, the national security apparatus, the empire, if you will. If you think about it in that way, then yes, Telesur and RT and all the rest of them, they are a threat because they do provide that all important. It's not just counter narrative. That's sort of at the macro level.
Just counter facts.
It's counter facts. Exactly right. And they don't get their facts from the same places, from these carefully constructed channels that the other media outlets do. And so I think that it is important to keep in mind every time you see something. Now, I'm not suggesting that every single piece of information that ever comes out of any Western media outlet can't be trusted. In fact,
Sunrise was at 6:21 in New York this morning, for example. It rained yesterday afternoon. There was a three-car collision on the New Jersey Turnpike that killed three.
You know, that, or, you know, you find stuff in the Washington Post about, you know, secret AFRICOM bases being constructed. You know, I find stuff like that all the time.
For sure.
Actually, one of the reporters at the Washington Post, whose name is escaping me at the moment, is, along with Nick Terse, one of the two best reporters when it comes to what's going on in terms of AFRICOM on the continent. So there are certain areas, certain individuals and key issues that you can really get a lot of good information out from the corporate media. But what I mean to say is none of that is ever like on the front page. You know what I mean? None of that is ever shaping the global narrative about anything. It's usually buried in the back somewhere, or, you know, online on the, you know, on the website or something like that. But yes, I mean, generally speaking, the narrative that is presented to us in the controlled media space, it is manipulated. And, you know, one of the other examples I brought up in the article, and I don't want to, you know, go too deep into this, but those people who've been following Syria closely from the beginning remember the gay girl of Damascus. The gay girl of Damascus was, in the early days of the Syrian uprising, quote unquote, was one of the key bloggers that was considered a hero standing up to Assad, a hero of the Syrian quote-unquote revolution. Well, and actually I think The Guardian itself called the gay girl of Damascus at the time, quote, an unlikely hero of revolt,
right,
who is capturing the imagination of the Syrian opposition with a blog that has shot to prominence as the protest movement struggles in the face of a brutal government crackdown.
Apropos for an imaginary character, because...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, yes, captured the imagination of the Syrian opposition, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, by the way, it's a guy named Tom McMaster who concocted this identity and created this blog as theoretically as a single project for himself, though key questions remain as to who exactly he is and who exactly he was doing this for.
Yeah,
I don't know
not,
that we're going to get an answer for that.
Not a gay girl and not in Syria. Otherwise, right on the money.
Yeah, exactly.
Look, you've got this stuff operating at several levels. First of all, within the construct of the media, you have both the factual basis, the things that actually happen that have to be repositioned, because what happened implies you have to look at the agency, and of course things that are in violation of international law can't be admitted that way, so they have to be repositioned. And then you have the things that never make it into the narrative as facts. So the threat from RT, CCTV, you know, Telesur, wherever, Abiyomi Ezekwe, Eric Dreitzer, wherever, when you have, first of all, the allegation that was made at the United Nations of the strafing of Libyans, for example, in Benghazi, that gets presented. What doesn't get presented is the photographs by the Russian military of that place at that time showing exactly the opposite. And then you never have the narrative that follows from the break in the other narrative, because you had UN resolutions that were adopted as a consequence, supposedly, of this strafing. It was presented as the case. And then the war that took place afterwards, well, you have poison fruit of a poison tree. That should be the new narrative, and that never gets presented either.
Yeah, that's right. Or another example directly related to Libya that I think Twitter was particularly instrumental in propagating had to do with this story that that Gaddafi's military forces were raping women and being issued Viagra in order to do that. Now, this was reported. I remember watching, I believe it was Navi Pillay at the time of the UN Human Rights Council, you know, the chief of the UN Human Rights organization, talking about how, you know, despicable Gaddafi was doing this and the need for intervention in order to stop the use of, quote, rape as a weapon of war. But that side of the discussion, those of us who were decrying these false charges, saying that there was no evidence for it, none of that entered into the narrative. What did enter into the narrative was the allegedly on-the-ground citizen journalists verifying, quote-unquote, this allegation. Guess what? All of those on-the-ground citizen journalists, they don't exist.
Right.
And they didn't go on to prominent positions. They didn't get jobs at CNN or anything like that. They didn't even flee the country, you know, when ISIS took over and Al-Qaeda took over. None of that. They just disappeared into the ether. Interesting, right? How that happened.
Yeah. And going back to Libya, for example, on February 24th, as a matter of fact, of 2011, there was a piece that was published in the Pakistan Observer. Now, this is in advance of the UN Security Council resolutions 1970 and 1973, in advance of all of it. The US, UK, and French troops landed in Libya on an Indian naval vessel. That was reported in Pakistan in an English language daily there, the English language daily, the Pakistan Observer. I found it on the 24th. And yet, even after forwarding it to many news outlets for a period of 2 or 3 weeks, it never made air here. Now, these guys were able to find these Twitter tweeters, okay, and yet they weren't able to find an article in a mainstream newspaper in the region that disclosed that the U.S., U.K., and France had already invaded Libya.
Right, exactly. And again, I mean, the reason why is because they don't need to find them. They're manufacturing it themselves. That's what it comes down to. That's Look, I mean, this is not simple conspiracy theory stuff. Look at all of the evidence that exists before us, the mechanisms that they have. The government itself has been investing millions of dollars. They don't just throw that money away. They invest in things that they plan on using, and you can bet your bottom dollar they are using this software to manufacture these accounts. They are using the RICU unit in London and the CSCC in Washington for social media penetration, for controlling narratives. All of these things that we see and we wonder to ourselves, or maybe we wonder aloud, Jesus, where did this come from? How did this narrative get here? How did they start reporting this? Where did this lie originate? You start to see, you pull back the curtain and you can see the various, you know, mechanisms by which they propagate this stuff into the media space.
Yeah, it's frightening. So let's go back for a moment to Brazil, because that's, you know, been heating up over the past weeks. And this coming Wednesday, we're going to see the full Senate apparently vote on whether or not to impeach Dilma Rousseff. And then what would happen? I think they need a 2/3 majority, if memory serves. But in any event, what would happen at that point is she is automatically removed from office while a trial for her impeachment is conducted. And then that could last up to 180 days. She is president until 2018, unless she's removed from office permanently by the Senate and I think the full legislature after that. In any event, then Lula is still positioned to run. And as of the most recent polls, he's still the most popular politician in Brazil, despite the efforts of the right to tag him.
You know, what's interesting, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe Glenn Greenwald has spoken on this since he's on the ground there. I really don't know. But I wonder what Lula's poll numbers are after all of this has happened, after he was dragged out of his house in his pajamas, you know.
This past week, he's the most popular politician in Brazil by far.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is, what was his popularity before this happened, and what is his popularity now? I don't know. I would guess
that perhaps it was enhanced by their shenanigans.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what I would guess, that his popularity may have gone up because of all of this, because in many ways, and I think this is absolutely true, Lula is really one of the victims here. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, so information came out that Lula has some, like, you know, really nice house somewhere, and questions exactly as to how he was able to afford that. Whether that's real, whether that's manufactured by the right-wing media, I'm not even sure.
It's actually interesting because apparently the house that they've been talking about is finally open for public view in the media, and it's a modest middle-class house. It's not like, you know, a 38-room mansion that the former presidents of Brazil used to have for themselves with armed guards and slaves. You know?
Right, yeah, exactly. Coolie labor or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, they had, you know, you had the whole... there's a legacy of the Atlantic slave trade on the ground in Brazil, even more so than the United States in many ways.
Oh, yeah. I mean, didn't they outlaw slavery in Brazil until, like, I think 25 years after the United States did. Yeah. And the United States was one of the last countries. That's so, right. Yeah, I think Brazil was the last country to abolish slavery. And the legacy of it is very much in play today. And it plays into what we're seeing happening in Brazil politically. One of the things that – and this is actually true of all of Latin America. And I know we've talked about it before, Don. One of the things that angers the right wing to no end about the left in Brazil is that they see them as representing lower classes and lower races. They see Chavez and Maduro as Maduro the burro, Maduro the donkey, right. And they call Chavez an ape. A gorilla, right. A monkey. In Brazil, you have very similar sort of racialized views when it comes to working people and poor people and dark-skinned Afro-Brazilian communities and indigenous people and landless peasants and all of the rest of that. So there is definitely this sort of layer of racism here. But on this point about Lula, you know, if all of this plays out and if they remove Rousseff, so they put in Temer, right? Temer is basically – he's the vice president now. He's basically one of the point people for Goldman Sachs, for Wall Street in Brazil. He is directly connected to a number of key finance capital figures, including the head of Goldman Sachs in Brazil, including a number of other key individuals. I think we talked about all this last week.
And that guy, as a matter of fact, the head of Goldman Sachs in Brazil would be his – he's already announced.
Finance minister.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah, right. That's what I'm saying. So it would basically – this government would basically be a subsidiary of Wall Street. And the question – and it's interesting the way that you – what you brought up there, Don, that in 2018 – so imagine all of this goes down. Let's say this happens in the next month. Okay. Right. And let's say Rousseff is removed. Okay. Right. So Rousseff is removed in – June of 2016. Then they have like 18 months or maybe 20 months until another election. And let's say in that election, Lula gets elected. Right. Well, then what's going to happen?
Well, not just that, because now look, first of all, let's say they succeed in removing Rousseff, even for 180 days. If you look at Macri in Argentina, and if you consider the fact that the lineup is going to include this Goldman Sachs guy, you're going to see the immediate imposition, with majorities in both houses, by the way, of Congress, of severe austerity. I mean, at the basis of the charges against Dilma Rousseff, the charge against her is that she manipulated the budget so that the shortfall in revenue that was on the books at the time would not translate into cutting off two-thirds of the people who were in need of emergency government aid, so she was able to continue to deliver it. That would go away. You're talking about tens of millions of people getting food and housing aid. That would be cut away immediately. What
it's
are they going to do?
It's like in Argentina, right?
Yeah.
Macri comes into office and immediately the price of electricity soars, inflation soars.
The currency, right.
Government programs are cut.
$12 billion is given to Wall Street.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that is what you would immediately expect. But politically speaking, this is what I'm getting at, is that all of the same political conflicts remain in place. Nothing really changes.
I'm saying they'll be exacerbated by the actions of this interim government. I mean, they're going to create the conditions that are going to lead into the election, and they could end up losing both houses as well, despite the way the election law is rigged there.
But what I wrote about in my piece last week, and this is where I think the value for Wall Street comes in, is that in that intervening period, that 18-month period,
interregnum,
they could get the Trans-Pacific Partnership through, they could get TTIP, They could move Mercosur further along the right-wing path that Macri is leading it down. Right. There's a lot that they could do in that short period of time that would have disastrous implications long-term. And once they've signed on to something like the TPP or, you know, in these various blocks, these regional groupings, part of a, you know, free trade agreement of some kind, or TTIP for that matter, once that's happened, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to undo. You know, so
you're signing international treaties. I mean, they would be a casus belli for the United States if they were broken by a subsequent government.
Of course. And so, again, I wonder whether the right wing in Brazil and their backers in the United States, whether they know that a right wing government cannot survive long term in Brazil, and whether or not they're just playing for like an 18-month window to hammer these things through.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that Tony Solo and I talk about frequently, which is the fact also that driving this is, you can almost read a sense of desperation into the, you know, aggressive actions of these people, because you know that doing these things will lead to exactly the condition that they're fighting against now. You had the Brazilian military take over. You had the subsequent right-wing governments. It led to a social crisis that led to Lula, and the same thing in Argentina with Kirchner, and et cetera, et cetera. And so they're not playing a long game in terms of that planning, but a short game. Part of it, the driving, is they see a closing window, so they have to act now. And, of course, what they're going to try to do is to lay out stakes that are irreversible, that move the game out time-wise.
That's right. And, again, I think that they also understand, and they're, you know, they're not stupid. I think they also understand that the people of Latin America, regardless of their discontent with the governments of the quote-unquote pink tide, I think that they understand the people of Latin America are still left. And they're still, generally speaking, of an anti-imperialist orientation, that they look on the United States and Western financial institutions with a tremendous degree of suspicion, if not a complete hatred. And I think that they understand that they're not going to be able to have what you might call popular governments that will execute the will of Wall Street and of Washington, that instead they have to hammer these things through by hook or by crook.
Macri, by crook.
You know, Macri is an interesting case because Argentina is probably the least left of all of the countries in Latin America, or certainly in South America. Now, I mean, of all the major countries, maybe we could point to some minor countries that might be outliers. But of the major countries in South America, Argentina was probably the most fertile ground for a right-wing government to emerge on, you know, democratically. And that was by, you know, a hair's breadth, you know what I mean? That was by like less than 2%. I don't think that they could win in Brazil. I don't think that they could win in a lot of places. Now, Venezuela is an interesting case because they have a real economic crisis, so you never know exactly how people might respond there. But even under extreme economic crisis conditions, the right wing in Venezuela is still not terribly popular. And I think that this is what Washington and Wall Street understand, that their people in Latin America, that they have to ram these things through as quickly and as forcefully as they can, lest they be victimized by popular will.
Now, I think the big surprise for the right is going to be, and you see signs of it stirring with contradictions. We've discussed some of this earlier, but on the ground in Venezuela, you see the attempt by the government to organize various popular groupings together. In Argentina, as a matter of fact, they already exist in some ways in a more advanced form, if not ideologically, at least structurally. Massive union activity, for example, in opposition to Macri, you know, that kind of stuff. And you have been seeing the development of new constituencies in all of those places. We've discussed in Venezuela, for example, the people who actually live in the million new housing units that were constructed, a political constituency. The same for people who have been eating and living indoors and or not feeling threatened by the economic conditions in Argentina under Kirchner and Cristina de Kirchner. And also Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and also in Brazil under both Lula and Dilma Rousseff. Even where there's instability, there are people who are now part of the political calculus that never were before, that have power and are organized.
Yeah, like when I was in Venezuela, and I know we're running out of time, so I won't get too deep into this story. But when I was in Venezuela, our contact there was showing us around and showing us the public housing, the Misión Vivienda buildings, and pointed something out that was really interesting to me that I guess I should have known. It didn't occur to me. He said that the location of a lot of these public housing buildings, these communities of buildings, that a lot of them were placed in right-wing areas, in more affluent areas. And one of the things that the people, the right wing in Venezuela, resented more than anything else was not only bringing poor and working class people to live in their neighborhoods, but was the mechanism by which they stopped being able to dominate politically,
right,
in terms of votes. You now brought in new constituencies and changed the demographic makeup of certain key parts of Caracas, key parts of some of the cities. That then translated into an additionally strong voting bloc. And so there is a connection between the mechanisms of elections and the public housing.
Well, you have the counterexample right here in the United States, say in New York City, but cities across the country. We had Rand study guided policies that essentially broke up the centers of power of the black communities in voting by, reverse gerrymandering. It would essentially destroy the housing and concentrate people here, 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 and here, and that would completely change the political configuration on the ground. This way you have people doing it to reinstate, basically, through gerrymandering or whatever you want to call it, a democratic aspect to how population is distributed.
Yeah, and also, of course, to change the stratification of the society. I mean, the
right,
class-based sort of segregation,
right,
that had existed for, seemingly from time immemorial. And this is another thing that the right wing really resents in Venezuela, and is similarly in Brazil. What they hate about the Workers' Party is not, the mismanagement of funds or any of that. What they hate is the redistribution of the resources of the government, to
right,
focus on poverty alleviation, to focus on subsidies, to focus on low-income housing and all of these other, and schools and health clinics and all of these other things. That's what they resent more than anything else, because that money is supposed to be funneled into the pockets of the rich.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned schools, even more basic than that, but including schools. When you have the kind of geographic segregation that existed before this housing was built, well, then budgetary fights over water and sewer connections to where the poor folks lived took place, and they would get voted down. Now, the water supply to this district, which used to be just where the rich folks lived, but now has 2/3 of the population living in these apartment buildings, well, the distribution of that particular water system and sewer system as a resource changes completely. And so if they're saying, well, you can't give these people water or sewer, they're saying, well, and we can't have it either.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right. And so, a lot of these issues, I think, are in many ways, bubbling right just under the surface in a place like Brazil. And I think that, again, I don't want to speculate too deeply because I don't know the nature of the social movements in Brazil. I don't know them as well as I know the ones in Venezuela for that matter. But what I can say is that the right wing and their backers in Washington and on Wall Street are taking a very significant risk if they push too hard in Brazil, because the backlash from working people is going to be much greater than if they do this in a, let's say, a piecemeal, slow-moving fashion. You know, in other words, it's the difference between really wearing people down day after day of these headlines endlessly versus trying to move quickly. If they move quickly, there will be a backlash. The question is, how organized and how mobilized are the social movements in Brazil? We know that, like, the landless peasants movements there, we know the favela movements and the working class organizations, that they're relatively strong. Are they strong enough to take to the streets and to own the streets in perpetuity without necessarily a definitive endpoint? Are they prepared to try to shut the country down? These questions, I think, are going to become central, because the harder the right wing pushes in Brazil, the more they bring the country to the brink of total social crisis.
Yep. And on that note, well, I just want one last point on that. You had enough strength among those groupings, those trends, to repudiate the right wing and elect Lula twice and then Dilma Rousseff twice. Whether or not the working class and its allies have strengthened themselves in that period or become weakened, I guess, is the question that we're going to see settled.
Yeah, and whether or not the way that this crisis has evolved, has that radicalized these movements? Has it forced them even more strongly to the left, even more militantly behind the Workers' Party and the other parties of the left? Or are they being broken down and sort of made tired and frustrated by all of this? I hope it's the former. I don't know if it is.
Okay, and on that note, Eric, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thanks a lot, Don. Always my pleasure.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.